I myself became curious when I started studying for this morning's class, this evening's class, started studying this morning for this evening's class, as to when we would actually get to the Gita, because still in these pages we're not having Gita verses. It's actually class number 5 that Swami really starts in quoting the verse and then writing the interpretation of it, and that's into the second chapter of the Gita. Until then, he does what we're going to be doing for tonight and for the next two classes after this, which is just setting the whole stage, drawing it out of the verses, but without quoting the verses. That was partly because at that point he wasn't exactly sure how he was going to end up writing the book. That was when he still thought it might be a condensed version rather than a whole version, and he was kind of drawing the essence out of the story. And then only a little bit, when he was about on page 50, I think is where it changes, he began to realize he was going to be going verse by verse, and then he started into that format. I think he would have changed the front if it was appropriate, but it all works because we're really setting the scene. Just in case you began to wonder, you might have checked ahead too, but okay. So before I start with these new pages, are there any questions left over from last week? Did anyone have any thoughts that need answering, or shall I just go on? We have a microphone. If you ask questions, we'll pass it over to you for the sake of recording. Okay, nobody has any burning questions. So the first chapter we're dealing with, chapters 2 and 3 of the book, not of the Gita itself, Swami's sort of giving us the background and the context in which the Gita takes place. The Gita being an extract from the Mahabharata, that whole huge epic with all the stories that go with it, it becomes irrelevant to the story, to the Gita itself. Once you get engaged in it, it's really just a dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna about how to live the spiritual life. But part of what gives that dialogue its power is understanding the whole context of the battle and the whole allegory that it's set in, because then you realize that the conversation was not abstract. It was genuinely a devotee facing a very serious problem in his life, and his guru, personified in Krishna, giving him really concrete answers. It's part of what makes this story, makes this scripture so magnetic, even for individuals, even all this time later, because it isn't just happening on some theoretical plane. It isn't some Himalayan yogi utterly divorced from the challenge that we're facing, just describing something that he's long past. It's the power of wisdom drawn out by the devotee's desperate need. And Arjuna's need is truly desperate. It's desperate in the external battle, which really happened in a similar way to the way it's described. And it's desperate because, as we go through these chapters and it becomes abundantly clear, we are always on the battlefield of the fight between the upward-moving God-inspired energy and the downward-moving materially attached energy, and that war is being fought literally every minute. And it's not a theory. It's an everyday decision that determines what comes after it. Everything about our life experience has all been this cumulative result of each of these individual actions. Swamiji talks about that in a minute, so I don't want to speak about it too much right now. One thing that's very wonderful about this story for us is that the two main characters, Krishna and Arjuna, are both manifestations of the same line of gurus, the same gurus that we are presently following. And it really makes it our scripture. I don't mean that in the sense of dogmatism and therefore it's more important or therefore it's better because after all it's ours, in the way that people do those things. But there are vibrations. The project of attunement on the spiritual path, which we'll also talk about a little later as we go into this, the aspect of the spiritual path of being attuned to the particular ray of divine consciousness that is the ray divinely ordained and recognized by your own nature as your pathway, to stay on that vibration at all times is one of the fundamental keys to real success on the spiritual path. Now, the Gita has an enormously broad application and appeal, because in India, Krishna is one of the most revered exponents of Sanatana Dharma. But for followers of our path, which Swamiji doesn't put into this volume because this is for a more public audience, but in other places where Swamiji has written about things Master said, Master made that the simple statement that in a previous incarnation, he was Arjuna. In a previous incarnation, Babaji, the deathless Himalayan master, lived in the, as the body in Krishna, as the soul in Krishna. And so when we hear Krishna and Babaji talking, of Arjuna talking to each other, we're listening to a dialogue between two of our primary gurus. So not only is it universally applicable, but the more deeply we, as devotees of this line of teaching, attune to it, we're going deeper and deeper into the absolute central core of what will eventually liberate us. At the very end of the readings for today, we talk about how the power of grace and superconscious intuition at a certain point is what really uplifts us. And we have many weeks to talk about the guru and attunement in other ways. But suffice to say, it's fundamental. So there's this, I was going to use the word double whammy, which is kind of a very not a very dignified phrase, but it's a wonderful aspect of this, and we shouldn't miss it. We should drink it as deeply as we can. Swamiji is writing this book also for India, so he spends a little time at the beginning here talking about the stories that are told about Krishna and a little bit about what they really mean. In this country, people are not raised on those stories, of these charming stories of Krishna tipping over the milk and playing with his mother and all those things. But Swami is also writing this a great deal for the Indian audience. He wants to sort of start elevating that concept and taking it out of the story form. When Beda Vyasa, who also wrote the Mahabharata, and, you know, wrote the whole Gita and the Mahabharata, the way the story is told is that he, with his expanded vision of the progress of humanity, he saw that Kali Yuga was coming, and that this story of the Bhagavad Gita happens essentially at the very point we are right now on this circular rising and falling of the consciousness on this planet. Except on that side, it was Dwapara Yuga ending. Dwapara is what we are going into. Dwapara was ending, and Kali Yuga was beginning. And so it was a descending cycle into a darker and darker, more materialistic age. Now the Kali has ended, and we're entering Dwapara. We're at the same place horizontally, but it's completely different whether you're going down or up. And in the higher ages, spiritual truth can be understood intuitively. Thoughts and understandings can be transferred intuitively. It's only when you begin to decline that things have to be written down. In history, they talk about, because all of our history is declining energy, they talk about the progress that was made when suddenly written language was developed. In fact, it was the disintegration of people's telepathic powers which required that they have to write things down. Well, Vyasa perceived that the ability to understand spiritual truth directly would no longer be possible in the Kali Yuga, to understand it even to the point of perceiving the non-material realities. So he wrote both the Ramayana and the Mahabharata in order to keep the kernel truth alive through those materialistic periods, which in fact, when you get any familiarity with the Indian culture, is precisely and exactly what happened. Even Master, in Autobiography of a Yogi, he writes that my mother drew upon the ancient stories of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata when necessary to illustrate the point she wanted me to understand when she was disciplining me. She used those stories to discipline him. And then they would get the picture of the characters and the things that they did, and then the values and the truths that are the foundation of Sanatana Dharma are all contained within those stories. And the whole culture of India, it's breaking down now. But until now, everybody just knows the stories, and they very in the most charming sort of way, will just illustrate their own conversation or make points or emphasize how you ought to do this or ought not to do that, because you know what happened to Bhima when he did this, and or even Ganesha or this one or that one. And it's a very common understanding that is both uplifting and also, to outsiders, very charming. And Swamiji, but the reality of it is that that form of understanding the truth is being made unnecessary by the advent of Dwapara Yuga. And that's why Swamiji also writes that Master said this particular commentary on the Gita could not be written until now, because understanding wasn't subtle enough. People weren't able to think in terms of energy. You know, it's just been since the 1900s and Einstein's revelations and so on, where just that mere thought that energy is a continuing reality, and that even his revelations of this whole universe is just the it's just energy in vibratory form. You see how completely radical that thought is from the idea that matter is a fixed reality and that there's nothing else but matter. But once you can start talking about energy and consciousness in frank terms, not just in parables, Jesus had to just, you know, totally obscure what he meant. And even Krishna, even Vyasa through the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, much of it had to be obscured. You have vast herds of cow herds, and you have cows, and you have monkeys that can fly, and you have just all kinds of strange things happening, not all of which, some of it is just a storyteller's embellishment, but much of which has very deep significance, and this is what Swami's talking about today. Now, the main characters, he often says in this particular epic, the main characters are the real ones, and the fictional ones are the peripheral ones. But what he's trying to illustrate is the forces in human nature that battle one against another. And so we have the main characters in the story. We have the five Pandava brothers who were all the sons of one man whose name was Pandu. And Pandu represents the quality of consciousness which is called buddhi, which is the power of the intelligent mind to discriminate. In other words, to look at this world and be able to draw fine distinctions, that true distinctions, the power of discrimination in a true sense, to be able to see what is eternal and what is not, what is lastingly real and what is not. Now, you can see that for the devotee on the spiritual path, the most fundamental thing is to be able to discriminate, to be able to know which direction leads me upward and which direction leads me downward. And he had two wives. He had five sons and two wives. The youngest, the three older ones were by his wife named Kunti. And Swami makes this distinction here that Kunti represents the power of dispassion. And Madri, who was the second wife, who was the mother of the two lowest, because these represent the chakras, the lesser of the two boys, the five boys, she represents the power of attachment to dispassion. I mean, we really get into very, very fine shades here. I decided to go and try to sort of understand what the word dispassion means, because it's a very interesting word. I mean, you start it in English and you say dis, you would think, well, it means free from passion. Passion in English, especially nowadays, is used in many different ways. People often use passion in a very positive sense to mean your enthusiasm, your determination, whatever it is that you love. So we have to find a clearer way to say that, otherwise it doesn't sound attractive. The state of dispassion is the capacity to be able to perceive reality as it is without being disturbed by any bias of the mind. And that's the best way to understand it. It's not a question. It's just the biases that we impose on the world around us. Another word for a dispassion is the word vairagya. And vairagya is a Sanskrit word, which is a wonderful word. And ragya means, in this sense, vairagya means, the way Swami has defined it, a disinclination for the things of this world. It's a really beautiful word. It doesn't mean that you don't participate, that you don't do your duty, but that you do it without any inclination to be attached to what's happening. Now, the whole story of the Gita is this war between this great force of desire for material things and those who are dispassionate, who are disinclined to envelop themselves in material things. And Swami makes this slight distinction that Kunti was the pure power of dispassion, just that impersonal force coming through. Madri was the attachment to dispassion. Is that how he said it? Yes, the attachment to dispassion, which just, on one hand, you can see it's the way you need to start. You have to have a desire for it. You have to have a commitment to it. But still, there's a little bit of I involved in it. I am the one doing it, which in and of itself creates that subtle kind of bias. Now, when we talk more about the chakras, we can explain more how this works. I know in a recent class I did a lot about the chakras, so I'm not going to do it all here. Master has a few paragraphs in here, which are really interesting, and he's just talking about how the chakras play out in the course of our life, because this is the absolute foundation of what the Gita is about. Because the battleground that is being described is literally the battleground of your spine. The battle of Kurukshetra takes place every minute of your consciousness within your spine, with which way the energy is flowing and what you are directing your energy toward. So Master has this paragraph in here just about how the human body is formed. And in other places, he speaks of when the sperm and ovum unite in the instant that they come together. He describes a flash of light in the astral world, and all those souls for whom it is their time to be born, who are in tune with that light, rush toward that light or are drawn toward that light, and one soul, usually, and sometimes more than one, but usually just one, enters into the single cell, virtually, that is created when those two come together. And it's because the soul has entered into it that everything else can happen. I mean, this is a very direct and flat answer to the question of when life begins. Now, reading through this whole section in this book about how this manifestation takes place, I just had this thought. You know, many people theorize about this. Scientists theorize, theologians theorize, people search the scripture and look for evidence. But when Master makes statements like this, and this is a matter of conviction on my part and maybe on the parts of most of you, but this is a perception on his part. This is the perception of superconsciousness that can look at how the universes are created and described how the universes are created. When Master wrote his poem, Samadhi, which he recommended that we memorize and repeat. We have some of the pieces of it up on the wall and the whole of it in the back. He just describes how the universes just rise and fall. And it's just an extraordinary story when you say it over and over again. Vanished the veils of light and shade, lifted every vapor of sorrow, sailed away all dawns of fleeting joy. Gone the dim sensory mirage. You know, just like gone the dim sensory mirage. They're incredible images that he draws. So when Master starts describing the sperm and ovum come together, and then when the soul enters, you see what the soul brings in to the sperm and ovum is its consciousness and the demands of its consciousness and how they're going to manifest in the material world. In one of his other writings in the Raja Yoga lessons, Swamiji has just this simple sentence that has been so vivid in my mind. We manifest a physical form. The soul manifests a physical form that is appropriate for the expression of the consciousness that the soul has to manifest at that point. And it stays in that form so long as that form serves the needs of its consciousness. And when that form no longer can serve the needs of the consciousness, then the form sloughs off. Now that is also describing, like, all through the animal level. When a lizard has like maxed out what it can do as a lizard, but its awareness is beyond lizardness, you know, then the lizardness will die. And the force, the individualized divine ego, Swami calls it elsewhere in this book, which is essentially the God-given individuality, slightly separate from the word ego that we normally use, but that spark of unique divinity that was that lizard, if it's not done with lizardness, it will just pop into another lizard form, and the soul intelligence will manifest another lizard. But when it's done being lizards, it will progress to whatever comes right after a lizard. I'm not really sure how all of those forms go. But then it needs more. You know, it has more awareness than a lizard can experience. And so it is when the sperm and ovum unite and the flash of light that happens in the astral world, the characteristics of that light are describing the potential for awareness, the potential for self-realization, really, whether the person is consciously or even anywhere near actuality, but they're on the road because everything is on the road. It describes the potentiality, and those who feel that their soul consciousness can manifest sufficiently through that will jump in there. And then it will busily begin using the laws of the material world now, because now the soul is out of the astral world. It can't manifest just by thought. It can't just change the forms of things just by willing it. Now it's actually in these cells, and it has to work through this, you know, the situation in the womb and the nutrition that the mother gives it and the time it takes to pull all these atoms together and, you know, just the whole story. And this is how I love Master says in here. Swami says, And the energy goes out through the nerves after manifesting them. It's like first it makes the nerves and then it sends itself out on them. And it begins to make a male, a female, a perfectly formed body, a tall body, a short body, a sickly body, a deformed body. There's nothing wrong with the soul intelligence. It doesn't accidentally goof and forget to make two arms. You know, it knows exactly what it's doing, but it manifests the body that reflects the consciousness it's supposed to have. It's such a beautifully interesting image, you know, and so vividly an active expression of consciousness and not just sort of these things that happen. You know, of course, there's not much capacity for the soul to express itself while it's still in the womb, but it's building all the blocks that are going to give it its life later on. So this descent through the medulla oblongata here, which is the sperm and ovum unite here at this point. The medulla is the point at which life begins, and it's the point at which from which life exits. Because the process of being born, which is that energy descends sufficiently to make a spine, to go to the bottom of the spine and then become locked there by material attachment. And there has to be some degree of attachment, otherwise we wouldn't have been coming into this world unless we're avatars and we're doing it completely from free will. But then when we begin to meditate or when death comes, the same process is followed in reverse. We descend and we extend. That's how we make a human body. And then when we meditate, we withdraw into the center and we raise the energy. And if it's happening in death, if you've ever been with anyone who is dying gradually, their extremities die, they lose control over their hands and feet, and they begin to become cold, and you can just watch the life force, literally. You can just see the paralysis and death is the only thing you can call it. It just gradually comes up the body. And then, you know, the breathing becomes more and more difficult, and the breathing becomes higher and higher, and then we go out the medulla the same way that we came in. And it's really extraordinary. However, in fact, the medulla has an alternative to it, which is the spiritual eye. And Swami has always said this over and over, that this is one of Master's clarifying contributions, is that these are opposite poles of the same chakra, and that the process of spiritual practice is to shift our sense of self from this point where it starts, which is the medulla, to its opposite positive pole, which is the spiritual eye. And for an ecstatic yogi in meditation, when the energy is withdrawn into the spine and lifted up, it bypasses the medulla and goes instead right to the spiritual eye. And in fact, that's why Master spoke about the fact, he said, keep your attention always at the spiritual eye as much as possible. You see, we look at the world through the medulla. It's very interesting. That's why we're so much more centered here. It's not really because of our eyes. It's because of the medulla. Because this is where we're looking out from. When we walk, you know, we only vaguely know where our feet are. We're much more conscious right here. And that's the esoteric reason for it. And one of the things that we do in the energization exercises is try to expand our consciousness in all directions as a way of being able primarily to move it from the medulla to the spiritual eye. What were you going to say, Sharmila? Good point. Sharmila, we're going to give you the microphone. Okay. And then you just hold it and pass it on to the next person. Okay.
So if I understand you correctly, when you say that the ovum and the sperm unite,
right,
life begins in the medulla, are you meaning that the soul enters there?
The soul enters when it yeah.
Is that what you mean when you say that it begins at the medulla?
It doesn't enter there because there is no there. The point where the sperm and ovum unite becomes the medulla. That's what you mean? Because, of course, there's no medulla.
Yes.
Yeah, the mother has a medulla, but the baby doesn't. Yeah, I know, it's very hard. The mind kind of goes like that. Okay, good question. All right. Any other questions or comments? There's a lot of esoteric touches in this, which are not necessary for you to understand all of them. I read these things over and over, and every once in a while I actually know what they're talking about. Swamiji talks about the nadis, which are the nerves. He's putting all this in here because sooner or later it becomes important to us. You know, some people are drawn to understand these things right away. Other people pass over them. But it's important to understand the objective reality of this. The spiritual eye, as Swamiji explains, with the golden, the blue, and the star, is a reflection of the medulla, because there are three major nerve channels through which the energy flows in the medulla, and it's that light which is reflected. It's the energy of the soul moving in this physical body that gives us that light image to see, and then we go to that light instead of having that energy merely descend into the body, and then we free ourselves from the body. I mean, these are words that are very interesting, and after a time we understand them. It's interesting that Swamiji writes that the blue circle and that blue is not quite right, we're going to have to fix it. The blue in the center inside the golden ring, the wrong shade. I mean, there's too much green in it. Swami walked in and he said, Asha, there's no green in the spiritual eye. I said, I know, sir, but we had a little trouble with the artist. Anyway, but the blue color is the color of the causal world and also the color, as Swami describes it, of the all-pervasive Christ consciousness. Now, remember all the traditions and legends that Krishna is blue? You know, my Krishna is blue and the blue lotus feet of my divine guru. We use that word all the time. We always talk about blue. And so then you see all these dramatizations, and whoever has to play Krishna has to get covered all over with blue powder because he's blue. And it's just sort of a strange little odd thing. I remember once we had a Christmas meditation that was extremely cold at Ananda Village. Somehow Swami insisted on opening the windows. It was about 30 in the temple. Even everyone was freezing, including Swami. Nobody thought to close the windows. And at the end, he said he was going to sing the song, My Krishna is blue and so are all of us. You know, it was just sitting there like that. But that's the inner meaning of it. And so when an individual goes into deep meditation and sees the spiritual eye and merges into that blue light, and that blue light expands into the cosmic consciousness, and you come back and you see these Christ-like figures who are described as blue, all of a sudden you know exactly what they're talking about. And then everybody else just has a good time with all these blue figures around, and they know that Krishna is blue, everybody knows Krishna is blue, and then a long time later, you advance enough to understand why he's blue. And you see how the truth is kept alive, even though the facts are lost, but the truth is in there for those whose consciousness rises to see it. And the other one I loved was Swami talking about God, you know, man is made in God's, in the image of God. And the image of God is the five-pointed star, you know, like this with your head on top. This is, and the star is always done this way rather than reversed. This is the five-pointed star. I just realized how crazy it is that so many people read that. Man is made in the image of God, and what they immediately then do is they create God in the image of man. He has a long beard, you know, long hair, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, and what we've done is we've taken our physical bodies and projected that God must have a great big one, right? But man is made in the image of God. What is God? God is the infinite force. And when we truly expand and through the spiritual eye, that takes us beyond creation altogether into the spirit beyond, that force which you would call the divine. It's so beautifully in there without really being in there. But now, because of the age we're living in and because of Master's unique mission, it's just written in a book that everyone can buy. Whereas before, these truths just couldn't even be explained unless you were already having the experience. It just wasn't time. People would be literally burned as heretics for even suggesting such things because it was so undermining to the order of things as people saw it. Well, each of the Pandavas, the five Pandava brothers, represents one of the chakras, from the five chakras from the base of the spine to the throat chakra, because once you move to the medulla and to here, you're out of the sort of the realm of human consciousness. And when we teach about the chakras, we talk at great length about how each of these chakras represents different aspects of our nature. But the main thing to understand in this particular context is simply that these figures, each of them by their names and by what they represent and by their unique relationships, by the fact that they had two mothers, by the fact that the wife, Drupadi, represents the kundalini energy, and Swami uses that wonderful word, by a concatenation of circumstance. Concatenation, is that right? Of circumstances, Draupadi ends up marrying all five of the Pandava brothers. And that's just a whole big part of the story. But the whole point of all of that is that the kundalini energy must move through all five of the chakras. It can't belong exclusively to any one. And it's the feminine power of Shakti moving through that awakens each of the chakras. And to awaken the chakra means to have that energy draw inward and upward. Because otherwise, as Swamiji describes, when the kundalini starts to come up, it hits the block. And that block is that instead of the portal being open in an upward direction, essentially the energy bends and goes outward. And so the energy rises, but then it goes in this direction. This is what we have talked about in some of the other classes, that the force of our energy needs to flow evenly up and be guided from our divine understanding instead of being expressed. This is not like it's bad, but it simply doesn't take us in the direction that we're trying to go. This is the battle that we're always in, is between the upward, inward and upward moving energy, or the downward and outward moving energy. Now, you have to understand, this doesn't mean that we don't act in the world, and that's where this whole story of it actually being a battle is so important. It's a question of whether we act with dispassion or with attachment. And dispassion is free of bias, and with a disinclination to grasp the things of the world, as opposed to the bias in favor of holding on and trying to define our happiness according to the waves of the sea instead of the depths of the sea. Now, the way the brothers, the five Pandava brothers, work through the chakras, the youngest is Sahadev and then Nakula, who are twins. And they are the power, it's described, of the yamas and the niyamas. And the yamas and the niyamas are the do's and don'ts of the yogic path. They're the 10 commandments of right action. And one, Sahadev represents the power to resist wrong action. Nakula represents the power to embrace right action. Okay. Now, you can see, and it's true on the spiritual path, that you can't really progress on the spiritual path until you have some ability to focus your energy and to move in a chosen direction. But these two are the sons of Madri, and Madri is the attachment to the power of dispassion, which is, as Swami says, that little bit of an I. And this is the part where the I is struggling to gain mastery over itself, just to put itself into basic order. It's interesting that the whole story of Moses taking the Jews out of slavery, and what he gave them was the Ten Commandments, which is they did not have any idea how to live as a free people, if you want to think of it historically. It's they had been slaves, they had been taken care of. All of a sudden now, they had been rescued from that condition. I mean, this is the historical reality of it. And they needed to be formed into some kind of a society that had its own rules, that could live by what was true for it. I mean, as slave people, they didn't even own their own bodies. There was no question of being able to follow moral principles or be loyal to a spouse or anything like that. They were owned by others. They had no mastery over themselves. So now they have been rescued from that, but now they have to take responsibility. So what Moses receives is the tablets of stone, and he receives 10 commandments. And it says, this is how you shall live. It's very interesting, just a parallel to that. Just after the slaves were freed in America, a very saintly man named George Washington Carver, who's better known for his scientific efforts with the peanut and the sweet potato and other things like that that had a tremendous effect on the economy of the South. But he was a black man. He was actually born into slavery, but he was a child when slavery ended. But he served the purpose in the life of the black people in the South that they didn't have any idea how to live because they had always been taken care of. They didn't know how to plant their own crops. They didn't know how to think for themselves. They just didn't have basic life skills. And he and the founder of Tuskegee University, whose name escapes me at the moment, but who was also another very dynamic black man, but less spiritually inclined than George Washington Carver. But George Washington Carver was a very great soul, a saint, sent to be born at that time in a very similar role to Moses, although on a very different level, where he just helped them to understand how to be a free people. And it was interesting just sort of seeing it acted out in his life, which is more highly documented. I was able to think back about how Moses worked with this. This is the foundation. And then when Swamiji would talk about the progression of the avatars and their message, you know, the Jews had to go from slavery to being a free people at all. Of course, the bigger image was from slave to the ego to perfect freedom. But the historical story was the one I was just saying. And then once they established law, then Jesus came and gave them a higher reality. It's not just God giving you a law. God is also a God of love. He's also our Father. We can move to the heart. We don't have to work so hard just to make sure that everything is right. We can move to the heart. And then Master came and we can move to, we don't even have to congregate. We don't have to work. We can move back into the intimacy of the relationship with the mother. I'm not saying that very clearly, but you understand what I mean, I think. Well, the way it works progressively within us is not dissimilar. So the lower two chakras are the Ten Commandments, the yamas and the niyamas, and that's the I has to get itself organized. And the two sons of Madri provide the essential, the beginning framework that supports the upper three chakras where the real inspiration can take place. But without that basic ability to live according to Dharma, according to right action, to resist wrong action and to act correctly, aspiration simply can't take place. But there's more ego involved, and that's where Madri is involved. There's more I involved in willing ourselves into that position, which then brings us to Arjuna, who is the third chakra, the navel chakra in the center of the body. And what Arjuna represents is the power of fiery self-control, because this chakra also represents the fire. And of course, that fiery self-control doesn't just come out of nowhere. It's built on the yamas and the niyamas, on the ability to resist temptation and the ability to do the right thing. If we don't have the power of self-control, then we cannot resist temptation or do the right thing. But once we are able to do those, the result of those, it's not just that we've done the right thing in the world, which is not a bad idea, but we have also laid the foundation for this fiery self-control, which is everything. Now, in the story of the Mahabharata, they repeatedly say that everything depends on Arjuna. That if Arjuna doesn't fight, the whole thing goes down. Because Arjuna's right in the center. And without this fiery self-control, the lower two chakras will just pull you away again and again into all the, because they really represent involvement with the material world. And if we have no power to resist all the attractions of the world that draw us away from spiritual understanding, the battle is lost. We have to have that self-control. Whichever way Arjuna goes is the way the battle's going to go. But once we have that self-control, we move up to Bhima. And Bhima is the Anahat chakra, the heart here. And Bhima represents the opening of the heart's feelings, but he also represents the control of the life force itself, pranayama. You know, this Arjuna is the beginning of it, but Bhima is the realized fact of it, which is that if we have the capacity to live according to the higher dictates of Dharma, if we have the power to really apply ourselves to those rules, the result of that is that we have pranayama. We can actually control our energy. So that Bhima, in the story of the Mahabharata, which really doesn't reappear much after these chapters, has this tremendous power because he controls pranayama. And in the story of the Mahabharata, the way it's told to be exciting, Bhima is always uprooting trees and using them to do things. I mean, he can just do superhuman things with his energy because he's followed the path of Dharma, he's developed the self-control, and now he can manifest it. He can focus his will wherever he chooses to focus it, and he can control the material world. And you see how that power is, and that becomes a power in itself that can just flow through him. Here with Arjuna, it's still, he is the great warrior, he's the one who's doing it, but with Bhima, it's just the power is unleashed because there's nothing blocking it. He's freed it up. And then we come to the fifth chakra, the oldest brother, who is Yudhishthira. They're born in reverse order in terms of their age. Yudhishthira, which is the throat chakra, and this represents enormous calmness and expansion of consciousness, because once we have learned to follow the rules, once we have the self-control, once we have gained mastery over our own energy, then what is there to fear? You know, just perfect calmness sets in. And so Yudhishthira is just this absolutely focused, completely honorable, perfect man, because he's the result of the efforts of his brothers. Now, all of these characters are given to us not because we really need to understand historically who the Pandavas are, but we have to understand that that's the setting of the battle. These are the main players on the side of good, the five Pandava brothers and each of the qualities that they represent. And so those are the warriors that we need to back if we are intent upon winning this battle in the way that we should. Are there any questions or thoughts on any of that? All right. This is all, I'm laying the groundwork. I realize it's a little bit abstract, although we've gotten off of that some. But this is just laying the groundwork, because this is what the story of the Mahabharata is about. And the Gita is about this actual battle, and these are the players on it. Swamiji talks about it, that he says, this in the next chapter, why cousins and why are they enemies? Why would cousins be enemies, and why is the story about one family fighting itself? He talks about the Mahabharata, he said, includes the whole story of how we descended into delusion, but it really doesn't matter to us that much how we got here. The actual only question is, what do we do about it now? I love one of my friends once, Shivani, who's very forceful, had a long seclusion, and she became very obsessed with this question of why did God do it to us. It felt at that time extremely important to her that she had to understand why we were here. And when she finally had the opportunity, she essentially walked up to Swami and just said to him virtually one word, why, like this. Swamiji just looked at her very intently and quite seriously. He said, Shivani, what difference would it make? He said, the problem you face every day is exactly the same. And this is one of the actual things that comes out later in the Mahabharata, in the Gita here, which is at a certain point when Arjuna asks the fateful question, some of the fateful questions that prompt the whole dialogue that is the Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, he says, you're saying these words and they sound really wise to you. This sounds like a very thoughtful question, and it makes you seem like a very philosophical and wise man. Why should I kill my cousins? Wouldn't it be better to do this? He said, but this is all just masking your cowardice and your laziness. It's that you just don't want to fight, so you're just going to sort of sit over here and just speculate, and that'll give you the impression that you're doing something worthwhile, when in fact you're just not, you're just a coward. You're not willing to get in the game. And when Swami was answering Shivani in that way, it was a very interesting answer, really, because it was like, I'm not going to do my kriyas until you give me this answer. It was sort of like just all the different ways that bias sets in. You see, it's not dispassionate. When we're dispassionate, we stand back and we say, actually, the problem is that I'm suffering. I can demand to be told why you made me suffer, but the fact is I'm suffering. And the other fact, which is further, is I won't understand why I'm not suffering until I get out of suffering. So Swami just says, we'll just skip over that. The Gita comes down to, what do we do now that we're on this battlefield? The soul descended, the soul got into this. You know, we saw one of those flashes of light in the astral world, and we rushed into that little sperm and ovum, and we made one of these bodies, and here we are. And we need now to retrace our steps so that we don't have to incarnate against our will and be drawn. Speaking about Pandu and the he's being the father of the five Pandavas, on the other side of the equation, the negative side of the equation, the father figure there is Dhritarashtra. And Dhritarashtra is blind in the story. He can't see at all. And he represents the blindness of the mind when it only draws its understanding through what it can perceive with the senses. And so many people that live in this world, you try to talk to them about spiritual things, and they just really literally just don't even know what you're talking about. I remember I had a relative, and he was a very nice man, and he lived very honorably. He was a very good man. But he just simply believed that the external world was the beginning and the end of reality, and that the external world existed and that we adjusted ourselves to it. And every time we'd have any kind of serious discussion, in a very short time, we would hit this insolvable, irreconcilable difference, which is, to me, consciousness was the reality, and everything else that happened was a manifestation of our consciousness. And he absolutely just simply couldn't even begin to understand that, because he just used his senses to see the world around him. It was tangible, it was self-evident, it was there, and he couldn't make that bridge. And that's how the mind is blinded, if you only believe the evidence of the senses. And so a whole slew of things follow from that. In this case, Dhritarashtra fathered Duryodhana. And Duryodhana is the master whimsically calls him the king of material desire. And these are the Kauravas. This is the opposite cousins to the Pandavas, the Kauravas. And Duryodhana is the firstborn, and he's the leader of, he has 98 brothers. Dhritarashtra gives birth to 99 fathers, 99 sons, how this is told. And his wife, let me see what his wife is called, Gandhari. The power of desire. The power of desire just begets all of these offspring. You know, you have desire, and it begins to create more and more and more. And Dhritarashtra also had another wife, and she was the attachments that are formed in consequence of your desires. See how subtle these points are? You have these desires, you get this thing you want, and then you become attached to it. And they have one son who's a very ambitious warrior, Yuyutsa, he's called, and he is the eagerness to do active battle to defend the things that the ego wants. It's just such an interesting sort of nuance there. Not merely do we have these desires, but after we have them, we become attached to them. And then once we become attached to them, we want to defend them. The importance and the... And so all the time in our lives, you know, you begin to watch, not only am I attached to being thought of in this particular way, but if somebody challenges me on it, I'll fight them. Because I've become attached to having that particular reality. And these are all the different citizens within our little personal army of consciousness that are battling it out like this all the time. One is fighting, the other is fighting, the other is fighting the other. So, in this battle of Kurukshetra, you have this enormous force between Duryodhana, who the way Master describes it is all of our other, does he say it? All of our other desires are subordinate to the ego's single desire to maintain its own place and position. So you have this whole war that's fought out, and it's all about Duryodhana demanding that he should be king and that everybody should acquiesce to him. And when the Mahabharata plays it out, you have all these different scenes where every so often Duryodhana, who's very in the story, very emotional, very temperamental, very dramatic, he'll go sort of in these dramatic moments where he threatens to just give it all up and he's just not going to fight anymore, it's just not worth it. And then all of his supporters will rally around him and tell him, yes, you can do it, yes, you can do it, we'll stick with you, we're on your side. And then Duryodhana will get himself all going again and sort of gets everybody, because as soon as those sense inclinations think that the ego is weakening its hold, they get very panicky and they want to build it up again. And so Duryodhana just has this absolutely unrelenting determination to be the king because he represents the ego's attachment to that position. And everything else falls in line after that. And when you start watching your own life, when you start thinking about your Duryodhana, you know, and watch how the ego panics at different times and how it so wants to be recognized and loved and how upset it gets when somebody pokes at it in a certain way and tries to take down its importance. And this is the battle that we're always fighting within ourselves, where Yudhishthira is just completely calm and expansive and unconcerned about his own position and concerned only with doing the right thing. And he just wants the battle to go forward in the right way. He's not protective of himself, versus Duryodhana, who is not the child of dispassion, but is the child of attachment to all these desires. And you see them, they're cousins because they're all manifestations of our own consciousness, but the values that they represent, as Swami describes it quite simply, are diametrically opposed. They're just two realities that are fighting each other. Now, once again, Swami emphasizes this, and this is why we talk about how they represent the chakras. Every day of our lives, every moment in our lives, the battle of Kurukshetra is really going on. Because at all times, there's this constant up and down flow of our energy, and there's this constant drawing outward of our consciousness into different thoughts and feelings. Let me just get this point, I want to get it clear. The way Swami describes it, and it's very interesting, he said, when we have a reaction to a situation, when we have a thought or a feeling or something like that, we have the impression that it comes and goes. You know, it just sort of floats in and then it goes away. Or we had an experience yesterday, and it's already dreamlike. Swamiji has used the image, which is very interesting to contemplate. He often says how very dreamlike this world really is. And you don't think of it because we live in the now, and the now is not that dreamlike. Here it is. We're all sitting here. We can see each other. It's a little cold in the room. You know, we're talking. We're hearing this. We're trying to understand. But just try to think of where you were exactly at this time yesterday, or even what you were doing at 10 this morning. And if your memory is at all sharp, you can sort of, oh yes, I was doing this or I was doing that. But can you grasp it? with the clarity even that we're having right in this minute? Can you even remember when we started at 7:30, just sort of exactly where we were and exactly what we were doing? There's just this very dulled quality to this world, which is quite distinct from the superconscious realms, where everything is vividly alive, and even from the astral world, where it's much more so than here. Because of that, and that's part of the way the delusion sort of infects us, we have this impression that once things are past, they've gone away. And it causes us to be inattentive on a moment-by-moment basis. Master has this amazing statement, which I repeat very often because it's so powerful. Take care of the minutes, Master says. Take care of your consciousness on a minute-by-minute basis, and incarnations will take care of themselves. Now, we tend to think of our lives, if we're, you know, active in it, what am I going to study? What's my career going to be? Where do I want to be in 10 years? I want a business plan for this. I want to have it all worked out like that. And we sort of think we have to think in these big, broad rhythms. Master takes that entire thing and turns it on its head. Take care of your consciousness on a moment-by-moment basis, and everything else will take care of itself. Because what you're dealing with on a moment-by-moment basis is this battle of Kurukshetra, which is the Pandavas are trying to draw the energy inward, and they're trying to raise it up to the spiritual eye. They're trying to draw us out of the ego identification of the medulla into the vibration of Christ consciousness at the spiritual eye. That's what they're fighting. The Kauravas, led by Duryodhana, which is the ego's supreme desire to stay important, defended by his brother Yudhishthira, I think his name is. I'm not saying it right, it doesn't matter. The one who is eager to do battle because of the things he's attached to, and all his 98 brothers who are just running around being desire for this thing and that thing, they're all right within our consciousness and trying to make their lives happen the way they want to. This is the battle of Kurukshetra. The Mahabharata is who is going to be king of the kingdom. And in the story, Yudhishthira tries again and again and again to forge some compromise. And this is also, you know, representing their gradual understanding also of the need to do absolute battle. Yudhishthira tries to forge a compromise with Duryodhana. And no matter what he asks, no matter how small he makes his demand, Duryodhana will not have him there and will not accept it, because the two realities are incompatible. You simply cannot interiorize your energy and raise it and also send it out into the world in attachment to all the things of the world. It simply can't be done. One or the other has to rule, or one or the other will dominate. And in the battle of Kurukshetra, the battle goes on, and it goes this way, and one side is winning, then these two warriors fight each other, and then that side is winning. And eventually, because this is the way it works, the Pandavas triumph, but not before the battle goes up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. Now, Master talks about it very simply, that the circumstances of our lives are always just what they are. I mean, they're just neutral in themselves. They become positive or negative, entirely based on how we respond to them. And positive or negative, in this sense, doesn't mean comfortable or uncomfortable. Positive means whether from that experience our energy goes inward and upward, or whether from that experience we let our energy go downward and outward. You see? That nothing in what happens actually says it has to go one way or another. It's only a question of how we respond to it and how we react to it. It's such a simple truth, but it's so incredibly powerful. And Master says every time we make that choice, it sets us in a certain direction and it has certain consequences. Among other things, actions repeated become habits. And a great deal of our life is simply run by the habit. And the habit becomes a habit, as Swamiji describes it, simply a habit of consciousness, of responding to life as if it were too difficult. He uses the example, he says, if the ego decides that the way to respond is with aggressive courage, as he puts it, He said, gradually you will develop both those qualities, aggressiveness and courage. If the ego habitually responds to life with a sense of, oh, I need to shield myself, I need to hide, I need to become smaller, then gradually that those citizens sort of become elected to the town council and they begin to make all the rules. And the whole Congress of your inner self makes a whole bunch of laws that say, when these things happen, this is what we do. And every single time we make those choices, we build and reinforce those habits over many, many lifetimes. Now, the character in the Mahabharata who represents habit is Dronacharya. Acharya means teacher. And Drona is the power of habit. Now, the odd thing in the story, which is also very symbolic, is that Drona trains both the Kauravas and the Pandavas. Because you make bad habits and you make good habits, but you make them equally. But Drona especially specializes in teaching them the martial arts, and especially the practice of archery, which Master explains, archery simply represents concentration and the power of meditation. That's what archery represents. Because you string the bow and it's a straight spine, the bow curves and it's the front of the body sitting in meditation, and then you string the arrow and shoot it through the middle of the bow. And the bow is often made in such a way that it looks like two eyebrows, doesn't it? Again, see, these are the hidden symbolism in there. And Arjuna is the master archer because with his fiery self-control, he's able to string the shaft of his concentration and shoot it straight to the goal. And there's many stories, including one Swami tells here, of Arjuna's ability to concentrate. And Drona, his teacher, has taught him the habit of concentration and the ability to send the arrow right to where it should go. Now, building good habits is really fundamental to right living. But the irony of this whole story, which is very confusing, and when you first read this story and you don't know this, you just don't understand this. Drona is a very noble character, but Drona ends up fighting for the Kauravas. And you just can't figure out why Drona, who's so noble, Arjuna is his favorite, he knows that the Pandava cause is the righteous one, and yet he ends up for the Kauravas. Now, the way Master explains it, he says, in the battle between aspiration and worldliness, he said, habit will tend to go to the side of worldliness. It's a very interesting point, and I want to really try to say this before we leave, because it was one of the more interesting things I read here. Master says, of course, habits are also your friends. That's why Drona also trained the Pandavas, and the first effort on the spiritual path is that you have to replace your bad habits with good ones. If you're in the habit of sleeping too much or eating too much or not exercising or not following a right diet or using bad language or becoming angry, all these habits that we've built up by constant repetition, we have to start doing the right thing and creating good habits so that we no longer, expletives don't come out of our mouths when bad things happen and we don't automatically become defensive when somebody gives us honest feedback. And we don't just habitually think, oh, I'm just going to lie in bed late or just eat a whole carton of ice cream at night. You know, just all the different things that are habits. We need to replace them with good habits. That's an obvious first step. Why not? I can understand, but it doesn't help. Okay. But Master had always, there was always been something that Master said that was very intriguing to me. And I only finally understood it when I read this chapter carefully today. Master said, it's not enough to be good merely because it is your habit to be good. And when I first read that, I thought, God, is there just, like, do we have no breaks here? Even if you just have the habit of regular daily meditation, won't that get you anywhere? Well, yes, of course, good habits are better than bad habits. But this is where the subtle role of Drona comes in, which is, good habits simply give us a clear enough channel that we can begin to receive superconscious energy and intuition. And above all, with the regular practice of meditation, as an example, with the following of the yamas and the niyamas, if we sort of walk our way up the chakras and begin to get those powers in order, it purifies, clarifies, calms our energy and attunes us enough that we can begin to receive higher inspiration. Now, a person who just watches television all the time, eats Big Macs for dinner every night, drinks a couple of beers and goes to bed. There's just no attunement there with superconsciousness. So there, the angelic forces won't be drawn, and the divine forces won't spend a lot of time trying to push divine thoughts into such a person, because there's no receptive vibration in order to receive them. Okay? Now, if we follow good habits, the yamas and the niyamas, if we develop the habit of meditation, if we listen to Drona and learn how to do it, then we become our wavelength becomes more subtle. Our energy is more refined. We become conscious of the possibility of our own superconscious dimensions and the possibility of the merging of our consciousness with higher consciousness. Now, it's the receiving of that energy which really transforms us. It's not the ego just doing the right thing. It's the fact that if the ego does the right thing, then we can actually become transformed. Because merely to do the wrong thing or the right thing is not enough of a change. Now, I've watched over many years, and this has always just puzzled me a little bit. People will meditate for years, or people say, oh yeah, I was a vegetarian for 15 years, and now I'm an omnivore. And I'll think to myself, how could you? How could you just, you know, understand enough to repudiate that way of eating and then just go back to it? And it's completely bewildered me. Or people will be on the spiritual path for 15, 16, 17 years of meditating, and then they'll just drop it. And this is where this issue of habit will side with worldliness unless superconscious intuition has lifted you above mere habit. Do you see what I mean? So people who, this is where Swamiji wrote years ago, he wrote this little piece called The New Dispensation. I don't know if it's still in print or not, maybe it is. It was this little pamphlet. And it was a revelation that he wanted to share with us. And his understanding was, even hours and hours of dedicated meditation without a corresponding effort to attune yourself with the consciousness of the guru will not bring you spiritual practice, spiritual progress. That without a corresponding effort, and then he also added to serve, because serving helps overcome the ego, but the corresponding effort to attune yourself. And this is where Master also says in one of the Sunday readings that we often do, he lists out this one, it's going to leave the path, but it wouldn't have to happen if they had stayed in tune. This one hardly meditates, but they make great spiritual progress because of their attunement. Because the capacity to be in tune is the willingness to surrender this sense of separateness and allow that grace to come in. So individuals who even spend a long time on the path, but it's only their habit to be good, when the battle starts, Drona sides with the worldly. Because just the power of habit is not superconscious. It's merely the ego repeating sufficient actions. If the ego repeats those actions long enough with the corresponding desire to be in tune. Now the desire to be in tune is discipleship, devotion, humility, prayer, service. Because all of that attunement is based on the recognition that this is not my power. You see, and how the power of habit can just make you think this is my power. But attunement gives you the experience that this is just energy that's just flowing through me. It's not mine at all. And anything that a person does with true inspiration, what really makes you feel so uplifted about it is the realization that I didn't do it. We have Swamiji all these years. What that man can accomplish, what he's been able to do, it's just stunning. And sometimes he'll stand here. I point here because he stood here once and did exactly this. And he just told us all the things that he'd done in that past year. And then I wrote this book, and then I wrote this music, and then I did these television shows, and then I traveled to this place, and I did these lectures, and oh yes, I forgot, and then I wrote this other book, and wasn't there one more in there? Yes, then there was another book, and just on like this, and people who don't know him just think, I mean, you can't help but think sometimes, you know, is he bragging? Where is this coming from? But for him, and then people will say, well, how can I be as creative as you? He says, oh, just attune yourself with the spiritual eye and pray to the guru. And then when it all happens, he is as amazed as everyone else. He just thinks it's just a remarkable demonstration of God's power. There's no I in there making it happen. All those years of Kriya practice and devotion and attunement to the guru have lifted it into superconsciousness. And so then it just happens and there's no I to have it happen. From that state, you're beyond habit, you see. It's not merely your habit to be good. It's that you have transcended habit itself and have simply become a channel for that flow of energy. Then you're safe. I mean, no, you're not safe till you're in Nirvikalpa Samadhi, but you're a lot better off. You're a lot better off in the development of your spiritual path if you do not rely on Drona. Because if you just rely on Drona, when the battle hits, he'll go to the other side and he'll take you with him. You see how very subtle that is? It really has helped me understand something. You know, understanding that attunement, let me think, there's just one more point on this, I want to try to say it. The most important thing is to realize that in times of trouble, you have to cling to that attunement with the guru. You have to do those things that will keep you in tune. It always breaks my heart when people disappear from the sangha. And when maybe I see them somewhere else or maybe they reappear later, they say, oh, well, I was having so many troubles in my life, I just couldn't come anymore. I didn't feel like coming anymore. And I always think, oh, well, the more trouble you're in, the more you should come. Because otherwise, your habits, your old habits will just take you, because attunement also is very powerful in the company of others who are in tune or in the place like this place where the attunement happens. And see, that's another, how do I solve this problem? Do I just withdraw into myself and sort of try to do it my way? And is that my habit? Or do I realize that the more I can attune myself to that power, the more it will take me where I'm going? Does that make sense? So in this story, what you have is, you have that Arjuna, who's the great warrior who's going to fight the battle, but Krishna stands in his chariot and drives the horses. The horses are the senses, the chariot is the body. So Arjuna says, okay, I have to do this battle. I don't have the courage to do this battle. I don't know what to do. Krishna says, I'll be in your chariot with you and I'll take you. And that's us on our battle of life. I don't know what to do. I don't know where I'm going. I have all these conflicting desires. This soldier looks as good to me as that one. Sometimes I really want to be that guy and not this one. But we say, Lord, you're the charioteer. I will stand behind you. You guide the horses. And then we will come to victory. Even if, and we get into this later, Krishna himself does not fight. But he stands there with you, and that's your attunement. And with that attunement, you can face any enemy at all, and you will vanquish them. All right. We have a few minutes for questions, if we have any. Any thoughts or questions? John? Uh-huh.
Thoughts. Like, I thought maybe you were going to lead into thoughts are real, or thoughts come from somewhere, or they are here all the time, and we just tune into them?
That's Master Statement in Autobiography of a Yogi, which is one of the many, this overwhelmingly important statements. It's just as simple as this. Thoughts are universal, are universally rooted, not individually rooted. I mean, the one thing we think we own is our thoughts, don't we? But you see, the inner consciousness comes first. you have this certain pattern of energy in your chakras based on whether your energy is inward and upward or downward and outward. And once you're on that vibration, everything else is drawn to you, including what you're thinking, because of the vibration you're on. It's not that your thoughts come afterwards. That's a side effect of the battle of Kurukshetra that's going on. Because elevated thoughts are just as accessible to you as depraved thoughts. It's just a question of what radio station you're tuned into. And this is where Drona teaches you the martial arts. He teaches you to string the bow and concentrate and do the right thing so that you will be attuned to the right station. And that's why, and that's the power of dispassion. Dispassion is the free, and the power of pure discrimination that Pandu represents, to purely be able to discriminate and not just accept these thoughts that come, that pass through, and think that that's who I have to be. Swami once talked about getting a cold, and he just didn't have time for it, and the cold came in. He felt it enter, and he immediately turned on it, and in a very loud voice, which I won't do here, just demanded that it exit, and it exited. But he said he could feel that the cold really wanted him to relate to it. You know, it wanted him to think about its various characteristics and why he might be susceptible to it and all these different things. So what often happens to us is, well, Swami used the example once when he was feeling a little bereft from Master. And he said there was some water needed to be carried up to Master's room upstairs at Mount Washington. And he commandeered the task and took the water can upstairs to fill Master's water canister, probably with pure water. And Master was busy in the other room, and Swamiji so wanted his attention that he clanged and battered and, you know, spent as much time as he could, and Master just didn't give him any energy. So Swami just went out in the state of despondency, you know, that Master didn't love him. And once he began to let his energy drop to that point, all these thoughts to support that came into him, that, well, Master loves everyone. First he tried to reason with himself, but no. Yes, true, Master loves everyone, but he specifically does not love me, Swami thought, because I'm not worthy, of course. And then all the reasons why he was unworthy started filling themselves in under that. You know, once you go with any one of those soldiers, you start picking all those thoughts up. And then Swami was just really running with that. And then he just realized what he was doing. And by that point, he said it was too late to reason himself out of it, because all of his reason was on the side of why he was unworthy and Master was just putting up with him. So he went down and he meditated, and he brought his attention powerfully to the spiritual eye, and he felt just his energy rush like that. And as soon as it was here, just the folly of all those thoughts was so transparent to him. You know, there was just no need to even go there. Why relate to all those realities? Just forget them completely. And then he could just... the power of attunement returned. He felt attuned to the superconscious reality and divorced from all of this. Nothing had happened. He just walked up and down the stairs and went to his meditation room. It was just, circumstances are always neutral. It depends on how you relate to them, which way it happens, because thoughts are universal. And we just live for incarnations on a certain wavelength until we are exhausted by the pain, and then we sort of edge our way up. But the more we constantly lift our energy as much as we can upward, the more then we're literally tuned to that station and have shut out other stations. This is where the power of good habit helps us. But especially then, so that we get into the right flow. Okay? Any other questions or thoughts? Yes, James?
I don't know if I can articulate this very well, but from the standpoint of storytelling, I find it interesting that both Bhima and Yudhisthira are more highly evolved spiritually than Arjuna, and yet they play considerably less of a leadership role, in how the story unfolds.
Well, they're not, first of all, they're not really more evolved, because all three of these chakras work together. These are the upper chakras, and they work as a team. But Yudhisthira was the, in the story, okay. See, Arjuna was the pivot point that would determine which way the battle went. Because if self-will and fiery determination, if you don't want to go forward spiritually, you won't. Nothing can make you do it. And if your willpower is not engaged, the upper chakras will sink. And the only way that, and the power of the lower chakras will pull everything down. So Arjuna was the most important player, but that didn't mean he was more or less powerful. He was just the pivotal point. If Arjuna dropped out, Bhima and Yudhisthira couldn't win. Because this was the supporting energy. Everything has to be in line. And you had to have the first and second chakra in order too. This is easier to explain if you do it as earth, water, fire, because then you sort of see how the powers build to expansion. They build from solidity. The solid earth it becomes a little more fluid with the water, and then the power of the fire transforms earth. It frees it into the air, and then the air just expands into more subtle than air, which is ether. And you see how, but you can't do any of them without the ones that come before it.
The power to control life force, the pranayama, right. It would seem would have the ability to pull up.
But the five pandavas have to work together. Yeah. So you can't just say if Bhima doesn't have the cooperation of Arjuna, he can't do it. See that's what you're saying. Bhima is the energy becomes. I think powerful is the wrong word. The energy becomes more subtle as you go up. But that subtlety is dependent on everything being in order. You can't just pull one out and have the others be contrary. This power ceases to exist. You don't have pranayama unless you have fiery self-control. You don't have self-control unless you have the power of right action and the power to follow the yamas and the niyamas. So that one can't exist without the others. So the whole story of the whole story of the Mahabharata is how all five brothers have to work together at all times. But Arjuna is the pivotal one in the middle. And Draupadi has to marry all five of them. And she has to be equally related to all five of them. And all of that is very important because it's all symbolic, otherwise it can't work. Does that answer that better? All right. Well, I think that's it. That was a very abstract chapter. And it is not the only one. So, I'll do my best to ground them, but I felt myself out there a little bit, and I left off some of the other parts. it was very abstract. I think we'll have to work hard on this. Okay, thank you all very much.